Hi, and thanks for listening or watching, as the case may be. What follows is an interview that I recently did with Kathy Ryan, and here's a little bit about her. Catherine Ryan, RMT, is a Canadian massage therapy clinician, educator, and writer with a strong interest in patient-centered care, evidence-informed practices, and lifelong learning. Her postgrad education has mainly focused on various myofascial applications taught by international experts. Over her diverse 25-plus year career, Kathy has been involved in the profession in a variety of clinical, educational, leadership capacities. As an educator and writer, Kathy is most known for her keen interest in fascia sciences and research translation. She's contributed extensively to Massage Therapy Canada magazine and recently co-authored Traumatic Scar Tissue Management, Massage Therapy Principles, Practice, and Protocols, published by Handspring in 2016. In addition to teaching in-person workshops, Kathy also has several accredited distance education courses available at www.touchu.ca. That's touch you with the letter U rather than Y-O-U. And here she is, Kathy Ryan. So I'm here with Kathy Ryan, who is born in BC.
Yeah, no, born in New Brunswick.
Born in New Brunswick. I was going to say born and bred BC.
Born in New Brunswick. Went to the US for a number of years. My stepdad's American. My mom remarried, so spent some time in the US, and then came back to Canada in my 20s, Ontario. And that's where I became a massage therapist and came to BC in 2008.
Oh, nice. So yeah. Kathy's an RMT from BC and a writer who's been interested in fascia for many years, and I'm really excited, pleased to be sitting down having a chat with you, nerding out about fascia. It's one of my favourite things to do, and especially with someone like you, who you've recently published your book, and you've been going to these conferences that we were just talking about a moment ago for years, since the first one, the Fascia Research Congress. I'm interested in picking your brains for the next 60 minutes, both about your book and what you've learnt by, being interested in that field and trying to make sense of it in a way that one has to do when they're writing a book. So what have you learned over all those years looking back? You were just talking about that, the overwhelm of that first conference in 2007. If you look back at the things that were overwhelming you there, what's the kind of conceptual journey been like, and what have you learned, do you think?
Well, first of all, thank you very much for inviting me to come here and hang out with you, Mark. And you know, this is a really interesting experience for me because it's kind of a full circle thing, because I interviewed you, I think it was 2006, maybe.
I remember that, yeah.
Somewhere around there, because I had taken one of your anatomy trains and yoga workshops at the Toronto, the big yoga conference.
It was the Toronto Yoga Show, yeah.
Yeah. So this feels kind of interesting to be on the other side of the interview podium here.
Good.
And lots of fun. What have I learned? I think there's a couple of things that have been really significant for me that came as a result of my exposure to the world of fascia at that level from the fascia research congresses. I would say that Guimberto's work has really been a game changer for me. And just to really start to understand the nature of the different presentations of the tissues that we work with. Because I think as a massage therapist, doing my original training back in the 1980s, it was, pretty much very muscle-centric for the most part, our training and education back then, and very much about fiber and mass. And so I'm probably less fiber and mass-centric than I used to be, and much more aware of the more fluid environment and the loose connective tissue world that creates our sliding bubbles, layers, places, spaces. Because, it's often depicted as this two-dimensional sort of, here's a dense layer, there's a loose layer. But it's, the way that Guimberto's work has depicted it, it's much more of a all encompassing, intertwined kind of environment. So he really opened my eyes to that world. I remember seeing him show his video clip at the 2007 conference, and like everybody's mind was just blown because it was the first time we had seen that tissue alive.
Yeah, it was amazing, wasn't it? Everyone was so excited about that. It seemed like it was.
I think we scared him.
Did you?
Oh, well, I mean, the crowd. I think the whole crowd scared him because he's, you know, he's does lectures all the time, but I don't think he was prepared for people standing on their chairs, screaming, fist pumping, woo-hooing. I think it scared the poor guy a little bit. I think he took a couple steps backwards.
Yeah, I mean, it's such a vivid illustration of the way that that loose connective tissue behaves in vivo, isn't it? It conveys so much, you know, so much more than research. That, I mean, not that they're not important, but you know, text and research studies and all those kinds of things. Those images really changed lots of people's minds, I think.
It didn't, you know. I think in fact that was, you know, I could be wrong here, but I think that was actually what sent Gil Headley back to his fuzz speech, going, "Oh, wait a minute here, folks, I may have not gotten that completely correct." So, you know, because talking about the fuzz accumulating when we don't move, but actually some of that fuzz is the network of the loose layer, but very difficult to grasp the concept of that in non-living tissue because it looks and behaves very differently when there's no fluid.
Right.
You have to have the fluid in there to really see and understand how that network actually works and really start to grasp what it does in the human body. So I think that was a real eye-opener, aha moment for many of us was his work. So that was definitely one of the big ahas for me, was his work, for sure.
Yeah. And just picking up on the nomenclature, because I think it's really, really important. I imagine you've thought about it a lot in terms of writing. And you mentioned it in the highlights article that you wrote from the Congress last year. So first off, do you want to tell me about how you think about or name the tissue formerly known as fascia?
No.
You know, because it seems like there's lots of confusion, and
there,
I
mean, is.
The way that I talk about it is probably pretty crude, in that, you know, making a differentiation between loose packed connective tissue and regular dense connective tissue. But what are your thoughts on, first off, on at what you think the most useful differentiations are for practical purposes, thinking about fascial behavior for manual therapists, and where we're up to in terms of the naming dilemma?
You know, I'm definitely going to step away from the naming thing altogether, because I'm not an anatomist, so I'm going to leave it to them to sort that out. But I think from a very practical perspective as a clinician, for me, you know, I just look at it in terms as the denser stuff and the loose stuff. And just really looking at what we know thus far about the inherent natures of the denser stuff and the loose stuff. And in terms of what it looks like and how it behaves when it's normal and healthy, and then what it looks like and how it behaves when it's not. And then, of course, as a clinician, I'm really interested in when it's not working, why is it not working? Is there anything that I can do with my hands to help it work better? And, you know, I was talking about Guimberto's work being such a game changer for me, because it really did draw me away from most of my hands-on being focused on, at the time, what I thought was the denser stuff, to really start to want to understand the loose stuff more fully. Because what we're seeing now out of the fascia research is that's the stuff that might be the most amenable to manual therapy,
right?
Is the loose environment.
That might be what we're feeling change. Yes,
exactly.
That we might have thought was regular dense connective tissue in the past.
For sure. And, you know, and I know Robert Schleip has said that his hands have changed dramatically as a result of what he's learned, because he was more old school Rolfing with, you know, heavier types of forces or pressures, to really backing off a lot. because it would appear that the looser stuff doesn't require as heavy load in order to get it to take notice and then create some downstream changes, as it were.
Right, right. So your book, the title of your book, Traumatic Scar Tissue Management, Massage Therapy Principles, Practice and Protocols, which people can get through Handspring Publishing.
Yes.
Amazon and various other places.
Absolutely.
Tell me about the journey, the process. I imagine it's been a long one. You're a busy woman. How did you manage to do that?
You know, it's one of those serendipitous kinds of things. In 2013, I went to the International Massage Therapy Research Conference that was being held in Boston, and I was going there to cover it for Massage Therapy Canada magazine. And so I'm there hanging out at the conference, and this woman approaches me and introduces herself. It was Mary Law. And, you know, she told me a bit about herself, and I kind of immediately recognized who she was, because she's the person, from an editor perspective, who was very instrumental in Tom Meyer's Anatomy Trains, this Journal of Soft Tissue Medicine, much of Leon Chatal's work, many, many others. So I kind of quickly go, oh, okay, yeah, I'm pretty sure I know who you are. And she started out, she has a nursing background and has been in publishing for forever. And anyway, she told me that her and a couple of her business partners had started their own new publishing company called Handspring, and that they were totally focusing on manual therapy and movement modalities. That's their passion. So they all quit their jobs for huge publishing companies and just wanted to focus on that. And they were looking for new authors. And someone had given her my name, and said that I had been doing a bit of writing in the massage therapy world. So she wanted to know if I'd go out for lunch with her and talk about maybe working on a book. And I'm like, yes, ma'am, I sure will. You know, and at lunch I said to her, look, I'm not one of those people that has like a manuscript sitting in a corner just, you know, waiting, you know, for someone. I said, but I love to write, you know, and I would love to, you know, talk to you about a project. I said, let me give that some thought. And she's like, that sounds great. So then the next day, one of the presenters at the Boston conference was Nancy Keeney Smith, who was presenting on her work with burn scars. She's a LMT in Florida, and she specializes in working with burn scars, and phenomenal presentation of her case studies. So I went up to Nancy afterwards and introduced myself and said, that was great, fantastic presentation, and carried on. And apparently later on the day, Mary Law also approached her and said to Nancy, look, I have been wanting to publish a book on scar tissue management from a manual therapy perspective for years. Would you be interested in writing a book? And Nancy said, I would love to write a book, but I'm not a writer, so you have to find me somebody to work with. And Mary said, I think I might know someone.
Oh, that's fantastic.
And so that's how that was born. So that's how the whole book started. So she connected Nancy and I. And I mean, as far as the actual process of writing, as I mentioned, I love to write. So it was a total labor of love for me. Writing is a lot of work. It is a lot of work. But for me, what was really helpful is that my clinical practice isn't full time. So I wasn't jammed, you know, and I could create some space in my world. We don't have small kids, you know, a lot of factors that I think would be more challenging for people to navigate. And for me, it was just really helpful that I could block some time, like 4 hours was a good time frame for me. So if I could once or twice a week block 4 hours to quiet house, totally devote to writing, that was really helpful. And we wanted to make sure that the book was really well cited. So being an RMTBC member, I had access to the research library.
Isn't that such a great service?
I think I was emailing Christina, their part-time librarian, several times a week. She's probably glad the book is done. But that was...
She needs an acknowledgement in there too.
Yeah, I mean, that was so... we could not have cited the book as well as we did if I had not had access to something of that nature. So I really appreciate that our association has that available for us. It's such an important resource.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Yeah. So in those four-hour blocks where you were diving into the world of fascia, going backwards a little bit, was scar tissue something that you were interested in before? Yeah, it was. Why so? I mean, why the fascination with fascia, first off, and why scar tissue?
I'll speak to the fascia fascination first. My fascia fascination goes way back to the late 80s when I was doing my massage therapy training. One of my instructors had just finished his certification at the Guild for Structural Integration. Mm-hmm. So, you know, he came into, you know, our class teaching assessments, and he started to introduce us to the world of Rolfing. And I was just fascinated by that. And, you know, back in the day when I did my massage therapy education and training, of course, Travell was the reigning queen. Trigger points was everything back then.
The two red Bibles.
Yeah, and I found it really fascinating that the title of the book is Myofascial Trigger Points, but then you crack open the book and there's nothing about the fascia.
It's mostly myo.
There's some great stuff about muscles. I mean, it still has some of the best illustrations out there, lovely illustrations, but there was nothing about fascia. So because my teacher was talking about fascia, and this book that was our Bible said fascia, but there was no information on fascia, you know, I tried to find information. I went to our local library and found Ida Rolf's, a couple of her early books were in our local library. So I devoured those and then just over the years continued to try to find information on fascia. And then eventually, you know, Tom Meyer's stuff came out, and then Robert Schleip's website became like, I think it's a good thing there wasn't a tracking function. He might have got a little scared by me how many times I was visiting his website.
Which is fascianresearch.org, it was at that point, wasn't it?
Yeah, but it was the only place that you could find information.
He was putting up lots of really good articles from really varied sources, too.
I know. Yeah. So that, you know, that became such a wealth of information for me, and it just carried forward from there. And then of course, after I went to Boston in 2007, the first Fascia Congress, that just blew the doors off.
Right.
And because I had to write this article, I had to go through the conference proceedings book. And I had never really read a lot of research prior to that, quite honestly.
Right.
You know, I had some exposure to it, but not much. But starting to read that, I just got this research reading translation bug and just started to devour fascia science as much as I could.
Right.
As far as scars go, again, right back to when I was a massage therapy student, one of my instructors, Susan Brimner, she had spent some time working, I believe it was the burn clinic in Toronto. And so she was teaching us how to work with scars from day one. So that became very interesting to me. And over the course of my career, I've worked a lot with athletes, and I've worked a lot with reattachment types of surgeries. And then that kind of evolved and, you know, connecting to the orthopedic world. So then a lot of my scar experience is really more orthopedic. So new knees, new hips, reattachments,
right,
that kind of thing. Some mastectomies for sure, but mostly the orthopedic stuff, yep. Whereas Nancy's more the burns.
Right. So I'm curious, is surgery classified as a traumatic scar, scheduled trauma?
It can, you know, I mean,
what's the definition of traumatic?
Nancy, that was the title of Nancy's presentation in Boston, was traumatic scar tissue. And the reason why she puts the traumatic in front of scar tissue is because for her as a practitioner, it's important to consider not only the physical presentation of the scar, but some of the other trauma that can happen with events that result in scars.
Right.
So that was a really important thing for us to do in the book, was to talk about not only the physicality of how to work with scars and work with them safely and you know, what to consider at the different stages of wound healing, but also to really consider the whole person. I mean, if I were, you've asked a question here about summing up the book, and I'm just going to flip to my notes here so I make sure I quote myself correctly, but really to sum up the book and to talk about why the name traumatic scar tissue, chapter one of the book starts with a quote from the wonderful and amazing Pam Fitch, who wrote Talking Body, Listening Hands. And Pam's quote is, "We're not just treating scars, we're treating people." with scars. And that really, for me, just so beautifully encapsulates what we do in our practices, is that we're patient-centered, whole-person approach to care.
Right.
So that's why the traumatic. So is surgery traumatic for some people? And for others, there's not as much of an emotional or psychological impact. You know, some people have surgeries, and it really is just more of a physical aftermath experience. And then for others, you know, it can be a totally different experience.
Right. So can you just talk about, you mentioned the stages of wound healing. Can you briefly outline what those are?
So, you know, basically we have that, you know, initial stage, and then it goes into the inflammation and the proliferation stage, and then that's followed by remodeling, the remodeling stage. So when we're working with scars, it's really important for us to understand what's going on in each of those stages, because that's really going to guard our hands to what they're doing.
What to do, yeah.
I mean, of course, first and foremost, it's always what the patient expresses their needs are. And what their goals are, of course, but as a professional, we need to be really mindful of what's happening in their body so that we can facilitate the healing process rather than interfere in any way.
All right, and what are the rough time frames? I know it probably varies per patient, but what are sort of ballpark timelines for knowing whether a patient's in one of those three stages?
You know, I think the first couple of days or so, the first a couple to a few days is when the most profound inflammatory stages are happening. And then it goes into proliferation, which is, I think, up to about 21 days, somewhere around there. And then after that, it transitions into remodeling. And generally speaking, remodeling can be anywhere from a few weeks to many, many, many months.
Right. Yeah, that window stays open for quite a long time, doesn't it?
It does.
To lots of the authors.
I mean, and I think for typically speaking, a scar will be termed mature after a year and a half or so under most circumstances.
And is your experience that after that year and a half, there's less change possible for that person? Like, what? Someone comes to you as a practitioner and they've got a scar that's more than 10 years old. What are your ambitions in terms of changing the tissue like?
Well, you know, this is where, you know, I get into, when I talk about scars, we're not just talking about the fibers. And we're not just talking about fibrosis. So fibrosis is part of it, right? So we have that.
Can I interrupt you?
Physical part that happens of, you know, we get new collagen and it's, you know, it works pretty well, but it's always going to, even under the best circumstances, it's always going to be a little bit different than what was originally there, for sure. But the other things we have to consider about scars too is what happens neurologically, blood vascular, lymphatic system, and as well, now we know there's also loose fluidy stuff in there too.
Right.
So
loose connective tissue, would you call it?
Yeah. So, you know, when we talk in terms of, can we make changes after, you know, 10, 20, 30 years? I think, yes, we can. Can we with our hands change extremely dense, large patches of gnarly stuff? Possibly not. But there's loose stuff in and amongst that fibrous, gnarly stuff that quite likely is still amenable to change.
Right. So what you're saying is that we're not necessarily able to change the physical structure of the scar, but we might be able to change its impact on the whole system, including the vascular, the neurological, and the loose connective tissue.
Yes, I mean, again, you know, a lot of what we're doing, we're taking our best, you know, sort of stab at theoretically what we believe is happening in the tissue, because, of course, I don't have any research that I've done to support that. But, you know, just in researching for the book, you know, all this research that we gathered for the book, and certainly based upon... you know, between Nancy and I, we have over 40 years of clinical experience and then looking at other people's clinical experience and talking to our patients, we know that changes happen.
Right.
We may not know exactly yet how the mechanism
yeah,
of
action.
Yeah, I was
going to say, what are the likely mechanisms? Do you
yeah.
think? I mean, I don't want to talk for too long about that because I don't know how important that is, you know, in a practical way. But what do you think the
I think it is important, you know, because I think for me as a practitioner, I'm really big on understanding process, because if you understand process, I think you have a better potential of really figuring out some complex situations. You know, so I think the mechanism action stuff is really important. I'm not a researcher, so, you know, I would not be able to explain that, I think, as well as some researchers can. But, you know, certainly if we take a look at Stecco's work, some really important stuff coming out of that, you know, everybody connected to Stecco and their, you know, work on densification, which is very different than fibrosis.
Right, which I want to ask you about in a minute.
So, you know, because they're really looking at some stuff that might explain some of these, you know, mechanism of action questions that we have that would answer our effectiveness dreams.
That's a nice way to put
you know, it. Along with others, Boris Heinz, you know, his work is really important, you know, because this is Mr. Myofibroblast guy, you know,
right.
Which is what drives fibrosis. So the more we understand about mechanotransduction and how that impacts myofibroblasts, we're going to see some real answers come from his work as well.
Can you talk quickly about mechanotransduction and fibrosis?
Yeah, well...
Let me interrupt you there. Can you talk about the terms first?
Sure.
So scar tissue versus fibrosis versus densification versus contraction, anything else you want to throw in there?
Well, to me, scar is just, you know, the word that is used to describe, you know, when there's been a wound, the aftermath of the body knitting itself back together. You know, to me, a scar is a normal thing. That's the end result of a normal physiological process that happens after we injure ourselves in some way. So for me, just to say scar doesn't, you know, mean it's a problem.
Right. And I just want to get really clear on this, because it seemed like in the 90s when I was doing my massage therapy training, scar tissue was something that was talked about a lot, and now it seems like adhesions are the thing that I talked about a lot.
Yes.
And it seems like people can get adhesions from anywhere. So what do you think? So can adhesions develop from stasis? Do they need what needs to happen to develop some kind of proliferation?
Well, my understanding is that there are a few things in particular that drive this process. So whether you want to call it a scar or an adhesion or fibrosis, from an actual physical presentation, they're essentially all the same thing. You're driven by the same process. And the things that drive, pathophysiological presentation of this material would be
of the tissue formerly known mechanical, as fascia.
Would be excessive mechanical strain, excessive or prolonged inflammation, and then of course there are local and general factors that drive over excessive wound healing processes as well. And stress is a huge one too. So people under stress might be at a greater risk for developing, you know, what we would describe as a pathophysiological outcome versus a physiological outcome.
Got it. Okay. So how would you make a differentiation between scar, adhesion, densification? And
so,
for people who don't know, densification is a word that the
Steckles
use. Yeah.
I mean, my understanding of adhesion is just a collection of aberrant collagen. You know, it's just collagen that didn't form well as a result of some kind of process gone wrong that will essentially stick surfaces together or stick things together that shouldn't be stuck together. So we see functional implications, of course, with adhesions. And certainly I know that immobilization is also one of those things that perhaps put us at greater risk of things getting stuck together that shouldn't be stuck together.
Right. And do you mean layers of tissue that should be sliding on one another, or fibers within tissue, or both?
Sure.
Anything that should be sliding.
Anything that should have the ability to, let's say, move independently within an environment that no longer, you know, because I mean, we do kind of break it down to these two-dimensional layers, but it is very much a three-dimensional network in there. So the best of my understanding is that, you know, anything that should have the ability to move around inside our body, if it gets adhered to, stuck, or squished in between other things, it's going to have a hard time expanding, lengthening, sliding, moving around in there. And so just to make the distinction between fibrosis and densification, fibrosis is a structural change. So it's a change in the way collagen looks. To instead of normal, healthy collagen, we get this roughened, fuzzy collagen fibers that don't function normally and have, let's say, a greater potential to start to stick together with its neighbors. Whereas densification is not a structural change, it's a change in viscosity or a change in the fluid environment. So this is what Stecco talks about, is they focus specifically on hyaluronan, and the molecular configuration of hyaluronan gets changed as a result of overuse or whatever the case may be. So hyaluronan under normal circumstances is a good lubricant that facilitates things being able to slide frictionless. But when its molecular configuration changes and it starts to glom together, it actually works opposite to what it should be doing. It starts to impede sliding rather than facilitate sliding.
Okay. So densification is a viscosity change. Fibrosis is proliferation of collagen. Did I get that right?
Well, it's proliferation, but it's also an actual change in the fibers look, as it were. So it's not just excessive amounts, I mean, which it can be that too, but what is being created is being created in ways that it doesn't function normally. So it's aberrant, it's unusual collagen, it's fuzzy instead of smooth,
right?
Or smooth-ish.
Right.
So it's more fuzzy, and you know, the way that I've heard it described is it's almost like it works more like Velcro. So instead of these things sliding past each other, you've got these little fuzzy outcroppings that start to get hooked or hung up on one another.
Right,
it's kind
more
of the
grippy.
Way it was described.
Okay.
To me.
So did I get it right that the mechanism for adhesion and scarring is the same, so excessive strain or inflammation. Is the same true for densification and fibrosis?
I mean, it would appear that with densification, I know with Stecco's work, they look at it more from a perspective of it's the end result of overuse types of situations. So again, when we're talking in terms of the body's ability to repair itself, there, as far as I understand, it's all the same process. So under the circumstances might be slightly different, but really it's all the same process. And the things that can make that process unusual or pathophysiological rather than physiological, certainly mechanical strain is one of those things that can drive overproduction of the collagen material.
Yep.
Excessive or prolonged inflammation, as I mentioned, stress is another one. With densification, I wonder how it relates to maybe repetitive strain injuries, where the problem is that there's not enough recuperation time between agitations. So the agitation itself may not be overwhelming to the body. The body can, you know, adapt to the demands, but it needs a certain amount of time in between those agitations in order for it to complete a particular process. So my understanding is that there's just not enough time between the agitations to complete a particular process. So I kind of relate it to one of the golden rules of weight training is that you never train the same body part 2 days in a row, because you need to give, let your body have that rest period so it can complete its process. So the breaking down, building up, to happen normally. Whereas with overuse syndromes, that's not what's happening. It's just, you know, agitation, and not that time to, you know, heal itself in between.
Right.
And that, I and see.
So that's similar to the excessive strain.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So, so just going back to the broad definitions, the densification is mostly focused in the loose pack connective tissue.
That's my understanding of Sekou's
fibrosis
work.
Is more of
collagen,
regular dense connective tissue.
Yeah.
Right.
So one's a structural change and the other is a non-structural change, is my understanding.
I see. I see. So taking this back to someone in the clinic who's treating a person with scars or adhesions or densification or all three.
Or one of those things.
Once you've identified an area that you think might be important in terms of, you know, densification or fibrosis or whatever it is, what do we do about it? I mean, in the 90s, like I said to you in my email, I was taught that we were trying to break down scar tissue.
Break it down. Release it.
Six frictions in one direction, six frictions in another direction. That'll break down the scar tissue. Obviously, that times have changed.
Yes, and no.
Yeah, tell me about the process, the thought process that you would, you know, I know it's hard to summarize a book into a few sentences, but how would you encourage people to think about how to approach these things?
Well, you know, again, as I mentioned, Mark, you know, what I'm doing in the early stages of working with scar is very different than when I'm working with something that's more mature.
Right. So let's assume it's in the mature realm of things.
Well, you know, I think the breaking down, breaking up, releasing adhesions thing, you know, take us right back to Cyriac's work.
Right.
And the provocation techniques, right? And, you know, Is it likely that if it's a very discrete area and we're using some kind of mechanical force to essentially perturb the tissue in a way that the body reacts to that and says, okay, that's not right, so we're gonna break that down, we're gonna catabolize that non-functional or that irritated tissue, and we're gonna go through this process. I think that still exists out there, you know, and certainly any one of us in practice have probably used friction techniques at some point in time in our practice, and we've seen some value come of that. That's one thing. But when we're talking about large fibrous masses in internal cavities of people's bodies, I question, I know my hands can't break that down, break it up.
Frictions, yeah.
Or release it. Nor do I think that we could safely apply provocation in a way that might be useful for that person. But I think what we can do is perhaps change some of what's happening in the fluid environment within and around that scar material, and as well, you know, how that over the years, maybe that scar has created some kind of compensations in the person's body. So we may not be, you know, in the mature kind of stuff, I may not be working as much directly right on the scar. I might be doing an assessment trying to figure out what kind of compensation patterns this person has developed. You know, much like Stecco's approach to working with scoliosis.
Okay. I'm not totally familiar with the scoliosis specific part, but...
Yeah.
What tools would you use to determine how that scar has created compensation? I mean, you don't need to be too specific, but I'm just curious about.
Well, you know, some of those same tools that we all use in practice. I mean, I'm a real visual and palpatory assessor. Right. Yep. you know, I mean, not to say that I don't use some of, you know, the various tests that we learn. I do use them, you know, when I think it's really would be helpful to the patient to have. And certainly if we're working with a motor vehicle accident or something like that, where I have to do really detailed report writing, you know, I want to do some things that I can really effectively track changes for a person just in general in practice. But I'm a real visual and as well a listener. So I listen to the person tell me their story, mm-hmm. what's difficult for them to do, and then show me what's difficult for them to do.
Right, so identify a task.
Absolutely.
And I'm interested in the way that the scar creates compensation in the whole system. Do you think that so you, at the start you talked about the not only the proliferation of collagen implying strain, but also the nerve and vascular component.
Mm-hmm.
Taking the vascular out of it for a moment, which of the sensory or the strain component do you think is more important? Do you think they're kind of hand in hand, can't separate them?
Well, if I'm quoting Jeff Bove, nothing matters but the nerves, of course, because they drive everything. A little shout out to Jeff. They're all important, of course.
Right.
You know, I mean, you know, the nerves can't exist without the circulatory vessels bringing them nutrition and everything else, right? So, I mean, of course, they're all really, really important. But as massage therapists, I think we all know that a good proportion of what we do in our practice is our ability to have really good communication with the person's nervous system and then to get the nervous system to do the bidding, you know, because really it is the nervous system that drives certain types of changes, including the fluid dynamic shift that happens in the loose layer. There's the nervous system is involved in that. You know, if you take a look at Robert Schleip's work on fluid dynamics, you know, he talks about the nervous system, certain specialized cells, probably myofibroblasts and other things that are involved in causing that shift to happen in the fluid environment.
Right. So paying attention to which stage the scar's in, assessing the compensation. How about changing, if you're seeing someone who's in that window of remodeling, what's the thought process there in terms of you kind of alluding to the fact that there's a lot of that it's probably more fluid change than collagen change. Am I getting that right? And tell me about the way to think about that person's scar.
Well, you know, when I teach this stuff, I often talk about that 2-year window of opportunity. You know, I think in that first year or so or two after an injury is potentially where perhaps we can be extremely helpful in maybe preventing a situation from becoming a really bad situation for a person. So, you know, I always see it as somewhat preventative in those stages to see if we can help get things moving, keeping them moving so that they don't unnecessarily get stuck over time.
And what would be the ways that you would not necessarily tell the patient, but be how would you know that it's likely that that person is going in a good direction versus, you know, putting up some flags and thinking, oh, this is not going in the direction that I think it should be going in. So what are the things that you're paying attention to in terms of assessment of the person and the scar?
Well, you know, I think pain is probably the biggest, one of the big determinants, right? I mean, generally speaking, of course, anybody who's had surgery or had an injury, there's going to be some pain afterwards, but usually it should not be a very long lived event, at least not excessive pain. So if a person's pain level is really high and existing, you know, longer than what would be considered within a normal spectrum, that's an indicator. Looking at the character of the scar, you know, just watching the scar heal and mature and looking for, you know, distortions or certain types of coloration that would indicate that perhaps things aren't going all that well for that person. You know, so some visual things that we look for. And then, of course, movement, you know, for the person, you know, what's available, what isn't available. which is factors into it to some degree. But the other thing with movement, and this is, you know, pretty particular to joint replacements, is sometimes we don't always have all the information about everything that was done during that surgery,
right,
and how snugly things were pulled.
Got you.
So, you know, I think movement, range of motion, you know, is, you know, certainly something to take a look at. But, you know, as far as if whether or not it's something that we can change with the work that we do is always somewhat of a question mark. Because I've had clients, you know, certainly who've gone through various surgeries where, you know, we get things moving to a degree and it just won't go any further. Ultimately, to find out that things got pulled a little too snug in there, and it wouldn't have mattered how much work we did or how much exercise they did, it just wasn't going to go anywhere without ripping it off of something.
Which wouldn't be indicated.
Which would not be indicated. Outside of our scope.
Right. Clearly.
Way.
So just talking about the exercise portion. So you've mentioned mechanotransduction in terms of the wound healing. In terms of the regular dense connective tissue and the physiotherapy kind of body of research around tendinopathy, has any parallels there in terms of healing of scars in terms of the necessity of loading them? That you've got any thoughts on that?
I mean, you know, my understanding is that tissues need to know what's expected of them in order to heal in a way that's going to get an end result that's going to work for that person.
They need to know what's expected of them.
You know, and one of the things where, you know, I've found that in my practice that, you know, where it's been helpful for people is in certain stages of their process, movement can be incredibly painful for a person to the degree that it stops them from going to physiotherapy. You know, I've had people say that, you know, I just don't want to go back because it's just way too painful. And that's not any slight against the physiotherapist. It's just the nature of the process of what's happening. So I think there are ways that we can use our hand to mobilize or move tissue around that's non-nociceptive, that can perhaps help a person get to a place where they can start doing those bigger dynamic movements that's not so painful, and they're going to be more apt to do it.
Right. And is that a principle that you would use in treatment or that you would teach in treatment of scars as non-nociceptive?
Yeah, I definitely am a Diane Jacobs fan in a huge way. You know, her work is just really tremendous. And, you know, I mean, you know, and she's very much of that mindset of non-nocicepting. I think that the reality is there are times when certain parts of our rehab is going to have some degree of discomfort that comes with it, and I don't know that there's any way around that.
Sure.
You know, but I think there are ways to minimize that, that it doesn't have to be absolutely full bore, no pain, no gain. You know, I think there are ways that we can start to develop a process that try to figure out ways to make it minimally invasive or uncomfortable for the person.
Right.
And I think maybe pre-mobilization through manual means might be one of those ways that we can make that whole process more comfortable for people so it's not so darn painful.
Right, for them to move.
Exactly.
Right, so getting the tissue moving with our hands makes it easier for them to move, creates a window for them to be able to move more.
Yes, yeah. Yes. And want to move and get up and move really feel like they're doing something productive for themselves rather than putting themselves in further jeopardy.
And is that how you would see the work that's in your book and, you know, your clinical work integrate in with the biopsychosocial model that, you know, is pretty popular right now in terms of, and I shouldn't speak for you, how would you see those two things integrating? I mean, you've obviously thought about that model, the biopsychosocial model.
Of course.
And the mechanical changing the scar and addressing the scar itself. How do you see those two things interacting, given that pain is an important indicator for progress.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think, you know, if you are a patient-centered practitioner, I think by virtue you're somewhat biopsychosocial. I don't know how you could dissect those things, much like trying to dissect the human body without the fascia, you know, and understand what's going on. You can't do that. But, you know, having said that, you know, I'm also, you know, we also have to be very mindful within that model of our scope of practice and not touch to slide sideways into areas where, you know, we not only should we not be, but, you know, areas that would put the patient at risk and put ourselves at risk as a practitioner. So I think you have to be really clear about your scope of practice within that framework. But I you know, if you're patient-centered, it's going to consider the biopsychosocial elements, of course.
That's a really succinct way of putting it. That's great. So we've covered lots of pieces there. if you were to sum up the takeaways from your book in a couple of sentences or 3 points, what would they be? If you could give a therapist a few pieces of advice about how to think about scars in their clinical practice, what would that be?
We're not just treating scars, we're treating people with scars. First and foremost, you know, and that was a really big thing in our book. You know, we've got a whole chapter on trauma. So it talks all about trauma and stress disorders and, you know, from a perspective of informing ourselves so that we can recognize when perhaps something is outside of our scope of practice and then take the necessary steps around that.
Sure.
So that's a big one, you know. And, you know, for me as a practitioner, just in general, you know, as I mentioned, the non-nocicepting or mindfulness around nocicepting, and that, you know, this work does not have to be painful to be productive. You know, that's a really big emphasis in this book, is to be really mindful of how we're using our hands and work well within, you know, what is comfortable for any given patient, to really listen to your patients for sure. And as far as just working with scars in general, I think fundamentally the most important thing is to really become well-versed in the stages of wound healing, really understand the process,
Right. Really
understand what's going on so that you can use your hands in ways that will facilitate that and not interfere with it.
Right. Great. I'm just looking at the time here. I want to be respectful of your time. In those 4-hour chunks that you spent writing your book, you did a lot of reading by the sound of it. What are your favorite reference books, anatomy books, otherwise?
Wow.
You got any? I mean, it does.
Well, my favorite publisher is Handspring, and not just because they published our book, but because they are totally devoted to movement and manual therapy. You know, so I would say, you know, anyone who's interested in movement and manual therapy, you'd want to check out what Handspring is doing, right? Because if you love fascia, you're going to love Handspring, because they've got kind of the who of fascia is writing books for them. So, you know, if you love fascia, that's where you want to go. For me personally, Pam Fitch's book I mentioned, Talking Body, Listening Hands, because I consider Pam our profession's resident expert on professionalism, the therapeutic relationship. You know, and that's a big part of, you know, what this book speaks to is working with people, right? So, you know, Pam, anything Pam has to say, I'm listening for sure. Yeah. Fascial Dysfunction, which is a Handspring book. Chital is the editor, but every chapter is written by the who's who of fascialdom. So, you know, anything you really want to know about fascia, working with fascia, you know, there's really great chapters in that book that introduces us to some of the movers and shakers in the fascia world.
Yep.
So I love that book. That's one of my go-to books. Stecco's work.
Yeah.
The conference proceedings book, so the FRC.
Yeah, always good.
Yeah, those ones there, like, you know, as long as you can have a palate for reading research, which I weirdly have developed, which is strange. Norman Doidge, you know, just great plasticity. Like, man, that just kind of blew the doors off the whole brain thing. And then, of course, Explain Pain, so Butler and Mosley's work.
Right.
Which is, you know, yeah. Diane Jacobs. Like, if you want to know anything about their work, just go on Diane Jacobs' website. She's got a phenomenal website.
What's her website address?
DianeJacobs.ca. You know, I don't know exactly. Just Google her.
Right.
Google Diane Jacobs.
Yep.
She is, fantastic. And then in, you know, researching for this book, started to look at PTSD. So Bessel van der Kolk's The Body Keeps the Score.
Okay.
Peter Levine's work.
Sure. Waking the Tiger.
What's that?
Peter Levine. Yep.
Yeah. And yeah, so all great. You know, those are some of the stuff that I was looking at researching. And as I mentioned, the research library at the RMTBC website.
Yeah, which is fantastic, isn't it?
I just pitched a tent.
Got a direct line there. What do you think defines a successful therapist?
Someone who is patient-centered and really enjoys doing what you do every day.
Yeah.
You know, I'm 26 years in, and every day is still just such a joy for me. So that to me is success.
Yeah, that's great. That's I mean, enjoying going to work is a
keeping the care and health care.
Yeah.
Are so, you know, our profession is so beautifully suited for that, you know, just by nature of our clinical structure. You know, we're spending an hour with people. It really gives them an opportunity to tell their story and for us to listen to their story and then respond, professionally to their story. And people don't often get that in healthcare anymore. Yeah. So that puts us in such an incredible, unique position to keep the care in healthcare.
Yeah, it's so important, isn't it, listening to the story? Because you can glean so much from listening carefully. And people are so often, grateful just to be able to tell their story because it often hasn't happened.
Well, and, you know, for me, like, you know, in terms of assessment tools, listening is like probably one of the most profound assessment tools for me. Just listening to a person describe, this is how it happened and this is how it's impacted me and this is what I'm still noticing as a problem. And, you know, when I do this, it actually feels a little bit better. And, you know, if I open the door like this, I'm okay. But if I open the door like that, that's a problem. So just hearing them describe what's going on for them, that really is like a huge chunk of my assessment process.
What are the describing, what are the adjectives or the phrases that prick up your ears in a facial way?
Stiffness.
Stiffness?
Yeah, because I mean that stiffness is not a muscular thing. Stiffness is a fascial property. Physiologically, that's what fascia does. It stiffens and unstiffens, stiffens and unstiffens. So as soon as a person says to me, I just feel stiff, I'm like, oh, that just reeks of fascia.
Yeah,
you know, it's got fascia written all over it. So stiffness is definitely a real flag for me for fascia.
And anything specific to scars in that regard?
I mean, certainly with scars, you know, some of the terminology people use around their scars are, you know, the itching and weird sensations. You know, people will say, it just feels weird. But I mean, again, you know, I work with scars, but I'm also working with what else is happening out there in the, you know, myokinetic chain, myofascial meridian, whatever we want to call it these days, biotensegrity system, you know. So just listening to them talk about
neuromyofascial web.
Yeah, neuromyofascial web, you know, whatever we're talking about. So, you know, I'm working with the scars, but I'm also working with, if something is stuck in a particular location, how that will overburden or overwork or overwhelm other areas.
Got you. Fantastic. Quick fire questions.
Oh, It's like Strombol. This is great.
Chocolate or vanilla?
Dark, organic, fair trade chocolate.
Could you be more specific? That was good.
I could.
Do you use lotion or oil in your practice? Or neither?
I rarely use either, but when I do, a bit of lotion.
Got you. Yeah. Bike or walk?
Walk, of course, and usually with a pack up mountains.
Up mountains.
Oh, yeah, I love to hike.
Cross country or downhill?
Snowshoe.
Snowshoe.
I love to snowshoe. A little bit of cross country, but I don't downhill. I'm afraid of what it might do to my hands.
Yeah. Cabernet Sauvignon or Sauvignon Blanc?
Oh, it depends on what I'm having for dinner.
Fair enough.
For me, it's more about the food than the drink.
Right.
So the drink is just a compliment to the food, because I'm really all about the food.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, yeah.
Favorites?
Oh, flavorful. I like really flavorful stuff, so I don't really have a favorite, but, you know, I love Indian food, I love Thai food, I love Mexican food, I love Mediterranean food. I love food.
Yep.
I just love the stuff.
Awesome.
I do not miss meals.
Well, look, it's been so great talking to you. We've covered lots of ground. What I'm going to do is go through and put links to all of the things you've mentioned in there, so people can have those, pieces as resources. And as I mentioned, your book's on Handspring. It's on Amazon. Have you got a Facebook page or a Twitter account or any of those things?
I don't. Well, I mean, I have a Facebook thing. There's nothing on there, and I get flack from my family all the time. But I had to have a Facebook page because of I have courses posted on touchyou.ca. So sometimes we get questions about the courses. So I had to go onto Facebook so I could answer questions in the TouchYou Lounge. But if you go to my Facebook page, there's nothing other than a little video of a moose trying to chomp down my bird feeder and a quip about me saying, I don't have any time to post anything. I got to refill the bird feeder.
That's great. And that's Touch You with a U, right?
Yeah.
Not Y-O-U.
That's right.
And if people wanted to take courses from you, how would they find out about those?
Like in person or
Either.
The online stuff?
Yeah.
So online stuff is on TouchYou. So I've got a 5-part Exploring Fascia series on TouchYou. In person stuff, the RMTBC is sponsoring Nancy and I's course. So possibly in the fall, we'll be running something here in BC. And then other than that, I mostly teach now through the associations across the country.
Okay.
So usually I'm at their annual conferences.
Yep.
I don't do a lot of coordinating my own courses anymore. That's as you know, it takes a lot of time. So I'm just happy to go when the associations give me a call and say, hey, would you come in and teach us? And I'm like, yes, I certainly will.
Yep.
I'd be happy to.
And you're off to a conference this weekend. So
I am. I'm off to the RMTBC's Manual Therapy Conference. It looks like a great lineup. I'm really excited.
I hope you enjoy it.
I'm sure I will. And then off to Seattle in May for the International Massage Therapy Research Conference.
Right. Another good one.
Yeah. And just one really quick piece of advice to all therapists out there. You asked me, you had a question here about...
Oh, did I miss that one?
Yeah. Just one piece of advice.
What would you give? What piece of advice would you give? A new you or a new therapist?
Stay current.
Yeah.
So just stay current throughout your lifespan.
How do you do that?
I read, I go to conferences. I mean, conferences are great, not only for the learning opportunity, but for the networking opportunity.
Right.
I mean, you never know who you might meet. You might meet Mary Law and she might, you know, talk you into writing a book. But, you know, it's so important because oftentimes we work in isolation. So the opportunity for us to network with our colleagues is really, really important. But I read a lot. I take courses. I still take courses, teach courses, write courses, go to conferences. Ask questions.
Yeah. Question your own practice.
Question my own practice, for sure. Absolutely. Yeah. Self-reflection all the time throughout practice.
Yeah, that's a great piece of advice. Yeah,
oh,
thanks
most
for
definitely.
Adding that in. It's really important, isn't it? Because otherwise we'd be still doing frictions, breaking down scar tissue.
Or ringing the doorbell on those trigger points.
Exactly. Great. Thanks so much, Kathy.
Thanks so much, Mark. It's been a pleasure.